The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. You can watch this by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. Today, the latest on healing, especially using spices that can make a big difference, especially curbing your stress. Also, my guest today will be Dr. Brent Blackwelder. He is the recent president emeritus of Friends of the Earth, post he's held since 1994, and he's regarded as our nation's most senior environmental lobbyist in Washington. And we're going to talk about a look at the economic fraud known as the nuclear industry and a rally to close Indian Point Reactor this Saturday in New York City, where I'll be one of the keynote speakers along with others, Helen Caldicott. It's a busy day on Saturday because earlier at Prospect Park, I will be there to support and film the movement to help close down but at least make people aware before they buy a food, is it genetically engineered? I believe we should open up a debate on it. Right now there is no debate. There's no discussion at all. It's just that genetic engineering dominates, but you don't know if the corn, the wheat, the soy, the dairy that you're eating has been genetically manipulated. We'll be marching from Brooklyn to Washington, D.C., a 316-mile walk. And then later on Saturday, to help another movement, I will be a keynote speaker to celebrate the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I will give you information on where that speech will be given. It'll be given at 7 p.m. So three major events, three major causes this coming Saturday. My guest will talk about all that. I will continue and conclude part two of the challenge to the safety and efficacy of vaccines today. I will lay out evidence of what really causes diseases to end, and it has nothing in the world to do with vaccines. And then next week I begin part three on what actually goes into them. The witch's brew of toxic ingredients you won't want in your body. Let's begin. Indian curry, many I'm sure have used that, can make a major difference when it comes to allowing you to feel more calm. This is published in the journal Nutrition. Let me quote this. Adding Indian curry spice like turmeric and cinnamon to a high-fat meal could help reduce oxidative stress and thus thwart the risk of chronic disease. Quote, normally when you eat a high-fat meal, by the way, the average American eats a high-fat meal, even vegans can eat high-fat, unhealthy meals, you end up with high levels of triglycerides, a type of fat in your blood, and that's bad. If this happens too frequently, or if triglyceride levels are raised too much, you risk heart disease. We have found that by adding spices to a high-fat meal, it reduced triglyceride response by over 30% compared to a meal with no spices. So, think of black peppers, cloves, garlic, cinnamon, turmeric, oregano, rosemary, and paprika. Those are the spices you want to use that, by the way, they all taste good, and they're good for you. And that's the latest on that. Now, from Paul Fass of Natural News, something I'm very, very strong believer in is the quality of the salt we use. When I travel, especially to other countries, I'm surprised at the variety of salts. There's one restaurant, for example, down in Florida, in Naples, that has like 15 to 20 different types of salt. And you have little tiny containers on a plate with a little tiny spoon, and some are pink and some are black and some are red. These are salts from the Himalayas and different places in the world. They're natural salts. They have different flavors. And it's just interesting. You wouldn't think you'd have that. And I remember once I was in California and I was doing a lecture, and I was invited to someone's home with a group of people after the lecture for a little meal. And the person called my office and said, "We know you're vegan, and we know you like raw food, and we know you like someone who you do your own food cleaning because you don't trust people. But still, we want to do something." I said, "Fine." So I got there, and everything else was laid out very nicely. But they had all these different things all prepped. So all I had to do is just wash them my own way. So I do my own wash. A little eccentric, yes. So what, right? They're looking at me like, "Oh, Gary, he's over the edge here. Gary, just eat the damn food." No, because I don't know where it's been. So anyhow, I go ahead, at least this salad, I made myself a nice big salad. But then to my surprise, when I sat down and they began to bring out the prepared cook food, they brought out a large board with little dollops of mustard. 35 different types of mustard. Now, mustard is a healing food. Mustard is one of our finest foods that we should consume on a regular basis. And I thought that was really neat. I thanked them very much. I thought it was very thoughtful that they would go to that extent. But then it turns out that the person who owned the house is into mustard, too. And then we had this whole contest, who could make the most interesting dish with mustards. And then you come up with all these creative ways. Like I like to take caramelized your onions, stir fry in your mushrooms, then after the heat's off, that's when you mix in your mustard, and the mustard then gently coats the mushrooms with the flavor of the onion. It's delicious. And then you stuff that into a baked potato. Anyhow, as far as salt use has been a controversial health issue for a long time. Most physicians consider salt to be a source of high blood pressure, but researchers from holistic health circles, including some independent MDs, have embraced pure sea salt as actually something that shouldn't be a taboo, providing it's used in lower amounts. And so then the idea is, all right, why sea salt? Well, normal refined commercial table salt is rather toxic and it lacks nutrients. It contains nothing of any value. The toxicity comes from the refining and bleaching process, which also removes all of the sea salt's naturally occurring trace minerals. Though we all need sodium to live and function efficiently, our bodies have a hard time recognizing it from refined salt, and digestion and metabolism becomes imbalanced, and that causes a toxicity internally. Our blood salt content closely resembles seawater, and all unrefined salt, regardless of its current origin, comes from the sea originally. Therefore, pure salt can be sourced from ancient caves as well as seabeds, and pure unadulterated salt has been consumed for centuries. Now, here's what you won't hear. Yes, refined table white salt I'm opposed to. But if you get really healthy salt, you can get it now. Salt helps to stabilize and regulate heartbeats, thanks to its magnesium and sodium content. Sodium is essential for proper muscle function. That's why when athletes are training and in the hot weather and perspiring, they have to replenish their electrolytes, and they also have to replenish their sodium and potassium. Salt helps minimize the effects of stress by maintaining proper melatonin, serotonin, and tryptophan levels in the brain. And salt helps the body hold water sufficiently for proper cell hydration. Salt helps remove cellular acidity, especially in the brain and the kidneys. Hence, salt is an alkalizer. Sea salt boosts your immune system, and since salt is taken into bone matter as part of strengthening the bones, it helps prevent osteoporosis. Sea salt provides a buffer for blood sugar levels to help prevent diabetes or to help those who are diabetic use less insulin. And sea salt provides iodine in its natural form. I'm only talking about its natural form. And also, it makes everything taste a little better, as long as you use it sparingly and use the real natural sea salt. Now, a lot of people say, Gary, I don't have a lot of money. I'm on a limited budget. What can I do, however, to help my brain function better? Well, if there's one nutrient that will help cells communicate one to another with greater efficiency and more completeness, that nutrient, inexpensive as it is zinc. And there are several forms of zinc, but zinc and alkylate zinc is good. Now, this is finally being discovered by mainstream medicine. This was done at Duke University Medical Center, published in Science Daily, and here's what it says, and this is in the peer-reviewed journal Neuron. Quote, zinc has been found to play a critical role in regulating communications between cells in the brain, possibly governing the formation of memories and controlling the occurrence of epileptic seizures. The collaborative project between Duke University Medical Center and researchers and chemists at MIT has been able to watch zinc in action as it regulates communication between neurons in the hippocampus, where learning and memory process occur, and where disrupted communications may contribute to epilepsy. Quote, we discovered that zinc is essential to control the efficacy of communications between two critical populations of nerve cells in the hippocampus. So I would suggest 10 milligrams of zinc a day to help your brain. I have, in my life, counseled, I'm going to suggest, around 5,000 people who suffer from addictive conditions. A lot of alcoholics, but more drug addicts. I've had friends who have been drug addicts. It's interesting to me to see what happens when a person is on a drug versus someone who has not had that first-hand experience but talks with some authority as if it's not that big a deal. I began to see this because at the institute where I worked for 30 years in anti-aging medicine, I also worked in drug interdiction because it was affiliated with Trafalgar Hospital, which was one of the major centers in New York that treated drug addicts, mainly with methadone. But the director of the center, since no one else liked the job, allowed me to use holistic protocols, including I was using intravenous glutathione push, intravenous B12 push, and suddenly the drug addict would be able to go off their drug without the convulsions, the hallucinations, the projectile vomiting. I remember once sitting there with a guy who said, I'm hungry, and so, you know, brought him in some food, and the dietitian from the hospital brought him in some eggs. And he's sitting there talking with me, and suddenly he looks at me, and I see this look in his eyes, and boom, it's like The Exorcist. Out comes these eggs, and we're on one side of the room, and the eggs hit the wall on the other side of the room. That's what happens when you can go off drugs. But I also noticed that with some people, especially during that period of time, when they were experimenting with magic mushrooms, which is all the rage, and you'd have these people come back, and they'd be absolute disciples of it. And then you have all these acolytes lining up because someone would be sitting around saying, oh, man, dude, you know, out there and would be, the, you know, doing the magic mushrooms and, you know, the doing the herbs and, you know, and we go into this altered state. And, man, it was so cool. You just couldn't imagine. And the spirits would rise up. And I'm thinking, you idiot. You know, this is all artificial. What they didn't appreciate was it only took one to create long-term adverse behavior. I saw it with marijuana users. I saw it with magic mushroom. I saw it with mescaline. I saw it with LSD. But for the person that didn't have that problem, then what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is, unless you understand what can happen, don't be suggesting people do something unless you can be responsible for the consequences. So where I believe in decriminalization, I also believe in being completely aware of what is actually going on in your brain. And I did a lot of this original research. And guess what? Just today this came through. And it verifies what I was seeing early on that nobody wanted to accept. First, I said that regular use of marijuana could create delusional psychoses and paranoid reactions. now absolutely proven. It also can create some long-term excessive psychotic and rageful episode and schizophrenic issues, also proven. Listen to this from Johns Hopkins Medical Institute, and here's published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, quote, a single dose of an hallucinogen can create lasting personality change. This is exactly what I was saying over and over again. I'll quote this. A single high dose of the hallucinogen, the active ingredient in the so-called magic mushrooms, was enough to bring about a measurable personality change lasting up to a year in 60% of the participants in this study. Lasting change was found in the part of the personality known as openness, which includes traits related to imagination, aesthetics, feelings, abstract ideas, and general broad mindlessness. And changes in these traits, measured on a widely used and scientifically validated personality inventory, were larger in magnitude than changes typically observed in healthy adults over decades of life experiences. So what does this mean in lay language? What this means is, you're going to do any of these, understand that a single dose, one single little experiment, is enough to change your personality in such a way that many of the higher end qualities of life, creativity, perception, are going to be lost. And we wonder why so many people who use drugs have such strange personalities, or are not able to connect emotionally or intimately as they once did. Now we know. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Like sweet morning dew, I took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
Like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. In about 4 minutes from now, we're going to say hello to my guest from Washington, D.C., Dr. Brent Blackwelder, talking about the fraud known as nuclear industry and all the lies about Indian Point and why we should close it and why we're going to be rallying to close it. This all began, as if you remember, with the last Wednesday's efforts to show the film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, a worldwide movement on the internet, articles by the dozens, and now rallies. And hopefully our politicians get this message. Just a couple things before then, however. I have a limited time only offering. We're offering a 2-for-1 special for this network of my Supremacy powder. The Supremacy is a delicious, natural cherry-flavored powder loaded with antioxidants and vitamin C and bioflavonoids. And it's the buy one 24-ounce container, and you get the second one absolutely free. And this is a limited edition. We only have 500 bottles. So call 877-627-5065. We have not had this special in over a year. 877-627-5065, one-time special, buy one, get one free, of the Natural Cherry Supremacy, the Buffered Supremacy, the one that so many people are so pleased with. So that's our special. Separately, I want to be able to say to our WMYE audience, where I've been here for 7 years, that I'll be signing off WMYE after tomorrow's show. It's 91.5 FM, but if you do not have an internet connection, for the internet, you'll be listening on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. But if you don't, just shift right over to 99.5 WBAI FM. So go from where you're at to 99.5, still at noon every day. You'll still hear the whole show. It's just that we have so many different feeds out of here each day in the New York area. A lot of it's redundant. So we're going to put them on WBAI 99.5 FM. And I want to thank the good people at WMWE, the official radio station in the city of New York. We've been number one there for a long time. But we have too many feeds each day, and we're just consolidating for the benefit of the people in the audience. So after tomorrow's show, you can listen every day at noon on Progressive Radio Network, or if you don't have an internet, just go to 99.5 FM. Now, we're going to get our guest up here in a second, but before we do that, I was stopped by someone the other day at a rally, and I was down on Wall Street and speaking with the people, and my first impression was that I don't see that this is something in its current form that is going to be sustainable, because virtually all the people I interviewed, with the exception of one, were people who came from privileged backgrounds, young people from privileged backgrounds, mothers a lawyer, doctors an engineer, people who've never had to struggle, who are not working, fearful of the debt, they have safety nets, versus the average American who doesn't have any of this, doesn't come from a privileged background. And when people try to compare it to what was going on in Egypt and in Greece, they shouldn't make that mistake. There's a reason to demonstrate, there's a reason to march, there's a reason to be concerned, but at least be realistic. We should be doing this to first mobilize specifically to stop all the debt for students in this country, which is $1 trillion, and also to stop home foreclosures, to feed the hungry, all the good things that we should be demonstrating for. And these people just didn't seem to have their mind on this at all, compared to the young people who were starving, who had graduated from college, had no jobs. People were struggling under dictatorships, tyranny, where there was no freedom of speech movement, no freedom of assembly movement. Greater sacrifices against them. In those countries, if you remember, they just weren't given some pepper spray. They were shot and killed. So we better understand something. We do a lot of stuff, and a lot of people show up just because some celebrities have showed up, and it's kind of like the hip thing to do. And only a handful that I interviewed are really understanding the larger historical context why we should be having a protest. Like, a lot of people really didn't know what they were protesting. So I'm not going to jump on this bandwagon like so many other people. Just because we do something doesn't mean that it's the thing to do. There's a way of doing something where you're organized. Otherwise, you end up with the phenomenon of the 70s, like Nader's Raiders. It was so hip to be in Washington, D.C. for Ralph Nader, but at the end of the day, how many people stayed around? How many people actually were there for the long haul? And a movement shouldn't be something that's kind of cheeky and clever and nice and kind of, we were there, we did it. Well, you were there for a day or a week, and that doesn't do anything. That doesn't cause actual change. Work on something that causes legitimate, ethical, honest change. I'll do more on that when I do my own lecture for Occupy Wall Street. But now for the person who came up to me the other day and says, you know, unless you're someone famous, unless you're someone powerful, no one's going to pay attention to you. This reminded me of what happens when we think that we have to have an enormous movement with lots of wealth before anybody pays attention. I want to remind you of something that happened a while back. It was from a young woman, Severin Cullis Suzaki, and she had been doing something as a kid. By the age of 10, she had co-founded ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization, with a group of like-minded grade 6 girlfriends at Lord Tennyson Elementary School in Vancouver. Their first project was to buy a water filter for the natives in the Malaysian tropical rainforest, whose water supply was threatened by overlogging and the affluence of an ever-encroaching population. In 1992, when she was only 12, she brought world leaders to tears with a speech at the first Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, in which she chastised them for failing to protect her and her friends from the looming environmental catastrophes ahead. So for those of you who believe that it's only show up if Michael Moore shows up, then that is, in my opinion, pathetic. Remember, you can make a difference. She made a difference. Listen in.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day, vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians, but really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong, in fact, 30 million species strong, and borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, you make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away, buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy, even when we have more than enough. We are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born. That I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
Let's say hello to my guest standing by, Dr. Brent Blackwelder. As I mentioned in the earlier introduction, he has testified before Congress on pressing environmental issues over 100 times. Earlier, he was the founder of the Board of American Rivers, the nation's leading river-saving organization responsible for preserving many of our rivers, which might now have disappeared, as well as eliminating over 200 dam and channeling projects that would have destroyed wetlands and wildlife. His organization, Friends of the Earth, is now in 70 countries around the world and assisting these nations to move towards renewable energy technologies. He will be one of the keynote speakers at the Nuclear Free Future Rally this Saturday at Hudson River Park, that's Pier 95, starting at noon. Nice to have you with us today.
I'm happy to be with you, Gary, and look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. Let us talk first about the nuclear industry. And I consider it one huge fraud, and I consider it probably one of the most perfectly exploited frauds because it has given propaganda, we call it education. Most people believe that nuclear is okay, either it's clean or it's renewable, inexpensive or safe, none of which are true. And the widespread GOP and leading Democrats also now support nuclear power, including Barack Obama, as did Bill and Hillary Clinton. This is a massive program, and it boils down to privatized gains and socialized losses. Could you go through this step by step and deconstruct for us in your own inimitable way why you believe that we have to challenge the nuclear industry?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. And we can go back and look at the propaganda coming forward during the last century, half century since these commercial nuclear reactors have been online. They were initially billed as too cheap to meter. This is just going to be the saving grace for everybody. Like that was totally misleading, and now a nuclear power plant may cost $10 billion, and even as they try to build some in Finland and France, they're running into one problem after another. Then we were assured that these are absolutely safe, that nothing could happen, and then Chernobyl comes along, Three Mile Island, and so forth, and then they keep the propaganda up as if it's clean and safe and everything, and then this year, we had this massive tragedy in Japan at Fukushima with three reactors melting. And their latest propaganda line, as you talk to industry, is, well, you've either got a choice of coal or of nuclear power. That's a false choice. They like to say, oh, how awful coal is. And we all know how terribly polluting coal is, right from when you mine it to when you burn it and what you do with the leftover fly ash. But they're trying to bill themselves as clean when they have never solved the basic problems that beset nuclear power from the very beginning. And we can go into some of those, the radioactive waste and the safety issues and the ongoing environmental problems, the proliferation issues. But one of the biggest frauds, as you were alluding to, I think, is to bill this as, oh, it's really viable and competitive, when this is a totally subsidized industry. It's astonishing, as you cited earlier, the Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz put it, when others bear the cost of mistakes, the incentives favor self-delusion, and I'm quoting still, a system that socializes losses and privatizes gains is doomed to mismanage risk. Yet that's exactly what the Congress has done with the nuclear industry. They keep putting a liability cap in the case of an accident when no private insurance company will touch it. So that should say volumes to us about whether this is worth doing. It's, if it's not safe for the people in the insurance industry who want to make some money, and they know the risks, they're pretty good evaluators, they won't touch it. And then who will touch it? Well, is any private sector capital going into it? A couple years ago, when the new Committee on Global Climate Issues was established by then-Speaker Pelosi, I sat in on a hearing that Congressman Markey, the chair from Massachusetts, had, and he asked the representative for the Nuclear Energy Institute, can you cite any private capital that's flowing into the construction of new reactors? And he said, well, we are not as subsidized as people think. Well, Markey says, wait, I'm not asking you that. Give me any examples of private capital that's going into finances. Well, he couldn't answer it. There was none. In fact, it's such a contrast now, if you look globally, that the supply of electricity coming from nuclear power has dropped since 2000 from 17% to 13%, whereas the amount coming online from renewable energy like solar, wind, from cogeneration and efficiency has gone up from 13% to 18%.
Well, let me interject for a moment, please. The nuclear industry has repeatedly stated that, well, if we go off nuclear, it could be 30 to 40 years before solar, wind, geothermal are developed to a point where they can take over. Could you address those lies?
Certainly. And that's one of the latest ones that you see going around now, as many of us are calling for the shutdown of Indian Point, which has been labeled from the earthquake standpoint and rated as the number one most dangerous. It's not the two reactors in California. So let's take a look at a country that is a can-do nation that gets things done. And Germany has been the one I have in mind. They have been and still are number one in solar electricity production, producing more solar electricity than the rest of the world put together. They've been number one in wind power until just recently. The United States has eclipsed them. But they are not even as big as the state of Montana. They don't have ideal solar or wind conditions compared to the abundance that we have in the U.S., yet they've moved forward. Now they are going to close down nukes. And how do they do that? Well, you can check actually the plan. These are people that want to solve. These are not people that want to throw obstacles. These are not the old troglodytes that are running the utilities and say, oh, if we don't do this, the lights will go out. No, they see how to combine solar and wind production. Sometimes wind is a lot better at night. Solar you use in the day with a biogas backup or pump storage for Germany. They have a plan. They've tested it out. You can look and get websites to see how this is done. They know how to do it. They have it in their plans. So for somebody here in the U.S. to say it's impossible, that's the same kind of misleading propaganda we've heard from day one. Reactors are safe. They're too cheap to meter. Baloney. None of that has come about. So it's the same thing here. We can do it if we want to. We have the talent. The obstacles are not technical. The obstacles are political. And where does that come from? The industry is spreading money all over the place to politicians, and as a result of that money, facts matter less.
My last
politicians need that money because of the expense of elections.
All right, my last question has to do with combining two issues. One I will be speaking with in depth this Saturday also, along with you and Helen Collicott and and former Congressman John Hall, Harvey Wasserman, Carl Grossman, Kevin Camps at the rally. Let me just tell you, the rally's Hudson River Park, Pier 95, that's West 55th Street and 12th Avenues, and it's from noon to 3:30. I believe I'm going to be speaking near the end, because I have to attend the other one on the March mm-hmm. on Washington to challenge genetic engineering at 11 in Prospect Park. In any case, I'm very concerned, based upon all the science we have been studying in my office and in detail, that the solar storms could, in the next year to year and a half, according to NASA scientists, could have an impact that could be so great on a curve, on a curve of easy, no problems to major electrical shutdowns, could shut down some of the grids by burning them out, and those grids also feed Indian Point and all the other nuclear facilities. These do not create their own electricity. They're brought in on with electricity from other sources off the old grids. If that happens, there's only so much backup, either diesel fuel or gasoline, whatever the generators are working off on, that they could have it resupplied at best maybe a week if they're working at 100% efficiency and without any problem. And then when they run out of that petrol, then they're going to have about 59 hours before there's a total meltdown, and you start seeing the consequences of a Fukushima here. No one seems to be paying attention to this possibility. And I don't want to alarm people, but when you've had so many disasters that we knew were coming and didn't prepare for, and or prepared improperly for, when you consider what this disaster could be, this could be a life changer as we know it for people in this area. And I want the Governor Andrew Cuomo, to know that we count, the people count, the people not just around the plant, but in New York City, because if it should blow, either from this or a terrorist attack or an accident, you're putting 20 million people in the greater New York area at risk of contamination. And I want people to call the governor's office and say no, close down this, no to nuclear power, close down the Indian Point, and we will provide him with all the scientists, the expert information to show him what he has been gotten this in the forest propaganda from the pro-industry people is wrong. His number is 518-474-8390, 518-474-8390. I know a lot of people called yesterday because we got feedback. I want people to call every day throughout the day and tell him close down Indian Point, because we're going to vote against every single legislature in New York and the governor if they continue to keep Indian Point open. And just closing it down is only the first step. Then decommissioning it and getting rid of all those spent fuel rods in a safe way, that's a major task also, because even if you close down Indian Point, if it was not operational, and if this solar storm hits, it will cause a steel meltdown, because these spent fuel rods are the real problem, and they are the ones that will be toxic for thousands of years. Your final thoughts on this issue, please.
Yes. Well, one of the things is that we can, as a nation, do rapid conversion. Franklin Roosevelt got Detroit to shift from manufacturing autos to doing ships and planes practically overnight. It is much quicker to put in motion all of these replacements. The solar and wind, cogen and efficiency can come in line up to 40 times faster than any of these traditional things, and you can get 20 times more greenhouse gas reduction per dollar spent. So we know the solution, and if people do what you say and get behind really demanding Cuomo, who he said he wants to close this down, just keep the demands up, keep saying go forward, get it done, and move forward in advocating all of these clean solutions, then I think the people have the capacity to overcome the political power of the entrenched utility executives that are trying to foist the solutions of yesterday, the polluting, devastating solutions, on those of us who hope for a cleaner energy future.
Well, for all of your tremendous work over the decades of founding one of the most important environmental groups ever, I thank you for being there this Saturday to support the work of all the people who have for such a long period of time been against nuclear, Helen Collicott and all the others. I thank you. Let's all get together this Saturday at from noon to 3:30 at Hudson River Park, Pier 95. That's at West 55th Street, 12th Avenue. And let's send a large voice out, a large shout out to the governor. I'll be organizing a protest and a demonstration in front of his office the following weekend. But this is where we build momentum. This is where we focus our attention. This is something we can do and do now. We can make a difference. That's why I played that tape of that young girl, 12 years old, telling all the world leaders, you got us into this point. You know, if you can't fix it, don't break it. And we have a broken environment out there because of greed and hubris and many other things. You're one of the few voices, one of the maybe 300 or 400 voices in all of America who's been consistent, always there. And I thank you, Dr. Brent Blackwelder, for your participation.
Thank you, Gary. I've enjoyed being with you, and I hope everybody will show up this Saturday and really send the message.
They will. We will have a packed place there this week. Thank you. And he is the founder of Friends of the Earth. I'm Gary Nall. Now over quickly to the part of our program. I'm doing this in bits and pieces so it's not overwhelming, and information about vaccines and how we have been able to lay out an argument that is based upon peer-reviewed literature, their literature, establishing that you cannot state with any scientific accuracy that vaccination equals immunization and protection for life and safety for any given individual. The protective level is arbitrarily assigned, as I've mentioned, meaning instead of taking one group who are vaccinated and another group who are not and seeing how they fare as far as their infection rates, instead they simply give a bunch of vaccines and they'll measure their titer levels, and a certain arbitrary number, they say, okay, you're protected, you have enough titers. Well, hello, I can show you people that have all the titers in the world who came down with the very disease they were vaccinated for. Therefore, there's no science behind this. So anyhow, the vaccine industry falsely claims that its vaccines work exactly the same way as active natural immunity. That is a lie. As we have shown on this program, vaccines do not produce the same quality and strength of antibodies that your own body would produce from a natural infection and recovery. Nor do they initiate cell-mediated immunity. Now, as I mentioned, there are two types of vaccines, inactivated, meaning killed, and live, meaning attenuated. Inactivated killed vaccines are inefficient because some of the antibodies will be produced against parts of the pathogen that play no role in causing the disease, and some of the antigens contained within the vaccine may actually downregulate the body's adaptive response, making you more weak. Also, vaccines of this type do not give rise to a cytotoxic T cell, which can be important for stopping infections by intracellular pathogens. Live attenuated vaccines may cause the illness they are designed to protect against, either because they revert to virulence or because some of the individuals they aren't sufficiently attenuated. If vaccine protection fades over time, then you will be persuaded to risk your health for a dubious benefit. But what actually caused the decline of major viral diseases? Vaccination clearly does not guarantee immunity in any given individual. So what about the decline of smallpox, polio, tetanus, measles, diphtheria? Looking honestly, doing it with scholarship, using a precise and completely statistically correct method, the epidemiological data, it is apparent that most infectious diseases started declining noticeably prior to vaccines being introduced. Sanitation, proper sewage disposal, clean water, improved nutrition, indoor plumbing, less crowded living conditions, elimination of child labor, and better hygiene were the real reasons disease incidence declined. Polio started declining in the U.S. in the 1920s, from 7,229 cases in 1921 to 3,826 cases in 1951. By the time the vaccine became widespread in 1961, the number of cases are already down to 1,076. There is no convincing scientific evidence that mass inoculation can be credited with eliminating any infectious disease. Furthermore, if vaccinations were responsible for this appearance of these diseases in the United States, why did they simultaneously disappear in Europe prior to mass vaccination? There are graphs, which are now posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNall.com, that clearly and unequivocally show the large drops in disease death rates occurred long before vaccines were introduced. From 1900 to 1963, when the measles vaccine was introduced, death rates from measles had declined from 13 per 100,000 to 0.2. That's a 98% decrease in measles before the first vaccine. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from whooping cough declined from 12.2 per 100,000 to 0.5 per 100,000. That's a 96% decrease in whooping cough before the vaccine was introduced. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from diphtheria declined from 40.3 per 100,000 to 0.4 per 100,000. That's a 99% decrease in the deaths from diphtheria before the vaccine was introduced. And then I have graphs from public health sources to prove all of this. So if you look at the actual data, even going back to England from 1838 to 1922, you see that despite enforced vaccinations against smallpox, there was no significant decrease in deaths from the disease. In fact, three major epidemics, 1857 to 1859, 1863 to 65, and 1871-72, occurred even though there was a very high vaccination rate. The last major epidemic was in 1872 and had death rates of 100 per 100,000, occurring just 4 years after a newer and more strict vaccination law was enacted. So public health interventions such as good hygiene, isolation, physical barriers are much better evidence-based than vaccines. The data suggests that implementing such measures are effective and relatively cheap interventions to contain epidemics of respiratory and viruses, with estimates of effectiveness ranging up to 91%. Yet you never hear this discussed. It is simply given as an absolute truth that, gee whiz, we'd all be dead if irresponsible people like Gary Null are allowed to influence anybody by suggesting they shouldn't be vaccinated. And I'm saying the hard science, the true science, is on our side. They are wrong. They have been wrong. And now it's for you to understand there's another side. All of my footnotes, all of my scientific references, all the graphs are on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. This ends part two of what will be a five-part series. Part three begins next week. Joining me in studio is Elizabeth, and she's here with your mailbag. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon. Hello, Gary. We had a man emailed us. He's anonymous. He wanted to say he was anonymous, but basically he wanted to ask you, there was a time about a quarter of a century, actually, 26 years, when you were a very prolific leading investigative journalist. You had an awful lot of influence with a particular publishing company. This man's from General Media. They produced magazines like Omni and Longevity. And he wants to know why today are you no longer in publishing, because there was a time when you were out there, you would take the publisher out to dinner, you both spend hours together having dinner, and you would discuss the sorts of decisions that this publisher would make. He would make good decisions when you were there, but he would make bad decisions when you were not, and people couldn't challenge any accuracy of the work because it was just brilliant. Playboy and other magazines that were producing progressive articles as well as offered you a substantial salary to go to them, but you refused. And this man, he actually wrote a very long email. It's over 20 pages long, but I'm just summarizing the very basic points, so sorry if it's coming out a bit garbled. But basically he wants to know, why are you no longer publishing?
Okay, well, first, for those who are ending this show today on their land-based stations, you can continue listening for the next 6 minutes on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I publish more now than I've ever published in my life. I have 10 books coming out, 3 this year alone. Articles, I am publishing more articles now than I've ever published. In fact, I just spoke with Richard Gale and said, Richard, how many different websites are carrying the latest article, which is part one of the Gardasil article, and it's over 3,000. Last year, there was one article that was carried by 153,000 separate sites, including the Times of India and major sites like USA Today. For about 26 years, he is correct. I wrote regularly major cover stories for one of the largest read magazines in the United States, if not the world. And I had a unique relationship with the publisher in that I didn't want to deal with all the politics inside the publishing company, so I just dealt with him. And I wanted unfettered control over what I was going to write about. And there was always this concern inside the publishing company, who are my sources? And I'm not going to betray my sources, because these were very important cover stories, like documents from the AMA showing that they had conspired against chiropractic. There were more than 2 million reprints that article alone that were requested, the most of any article, I believe, in magazine history, of any magazine. And millions of people read the articles. I was asked on different occasions, would I go to work and write articles for other companies? But these were the leading investigative journalist articles of their time. They helped, one got on 60 Minutes, one on 2020, and a lot of other people used these as springboards. It was a wonderful time, going around the world, uncovering secret experiments. That was October 1989 article about how the government was actually experimenting on citizens using radiation, like giving children toast with radiation in Chicago Hospital to see what it would do to the children's kidneys, giving live cancer cell injections at Sloan Kettering. A guy did it there. Why did he do it? But he got away with it. But we exposed him. So it was, for me, it was every day another hard-hitting story. The reason I stopped publishing with that magazine and chose not to publish with other magazines is because the publisher had hired, the publisher's wife had hired a person who I knew was had a criminal background, and they wanted to put him on one of my stories. And I said, no, I don't trust him. And I explained, I don't trust him. I'm not going to allow a person with such a nefarious background that you didn't know about to be on one of my stories. It could compromise. And this was a very important story. And as it turned out, I was absolutely correct, because information that this guy tried to insinuate in one of my pieces through the publisher's wife was wrong. It would have discredited the article. And that was it. I said, I can't come between you and your wife. I have no right to do that, and I'm not going to cause any conflict. I'm just going to go away. So that was the last article I wrote. After that, he did make a lot of bad business decisions. And before then, we would sit for hours, and he would say, I've got this deal, and I would listen to the deal, and I would give my input. After that, I no longer had any communication with him. But then I decided I really wasn't interested in publishing magazines. The internet was the future. Now the internet is the future. I can get an article out quicker. I can get it read by more people than at any time writing for magazines. The magazines, in my opinion, are passé. Just like land-based stations are passé. You're limited. So I've published over 673 articles. They're all up on my website. You can see them under my biographies. I have many bios there. You can see investigative reporting, documentarians, yeah, and all that.
Yeah, great.
So the future is investigative reporting using the internet, because we can immediately reach out to people. We can get people moving on an issue. In a magazine, you can't do that. That's not to in any way diminish what is written in Harper's or Atlantic, but we reach so many more people. I mean, we reach so many more. And I don't need that 3-month lead time, and I don't need, you know, 15 people wanting to know my sources. This way, every day I'm writing. I mean, just in the last week, we've published two articles. I've published two major articles that are now being read by millions of people.
Yeah.
All right? So if you're stuck in one field, then you're only going to be able to see reality from that field. I'm looking at communicating today using the internet. And that's why Progressive Radio, just Google Progressive Radio, and it's about 100 million, or more than all liberal and conservative radio combined. People are looking for progressive answers, articles, personalities, insights, information. they see the limitations of the other forms. Hope that answers the question.
Thank you.
I have more than 15 investigations going on right now, all of which wind up on the Internet. Thank you all very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more. Have a nice day. Stay tuned for Mike Fader. Now there's a progressive voice coming right at you in 60 seconds.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tablenfeld. I belong to you.